wakey. Thinking biggie.
It's time for an unbalanced breakfast with Matt and Catherine, a.k.a. Smart.
Hamburger, the cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast.
My boy says he can eat 50 eggs, he can eat 50 eggs.
Do you like apples?
I don't drink juice.
How about you, Sad Burns? You want some of this milk?
Bless his highly nutritious microwavable macaroni and cheese dinner that people are holding on sale. Amen.
They've got the hottest takes on the hottest stories and trends in food, nutrition, and fitness.
Come on! Bread makes you fat.
Bread makes you fat?
I haven't had a carb since 2004.
Calories. That's a gluten. Fat. That's a gluten.
Yeah, it's got electrolytes.
Filled protein combined with synthetic aminos, vitamins, and minerals. Everything the body needs.
I'm only eating foods with less than 30% calories from fat. It's 40%.
He read the squirrels were high in cholesterol.
We're about to find out what happens when a policy student and a science student interact.
And I also brought you some hydroponically grown goji berries with vegan barbecue sauce and some organic pumpkin chips.
Short answer, being vegan just makes you better than most people.
I happen to be a vegetarian.
You must have had vegetables fresher than that growing up on a farm, Greg.
Never trust a vegetarian.
Looks like meat back on the menu.
The views and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of WMFO, Tufts University, or the Friedman School of Nutrition.
Yes. Who's hungry?
And the people did feast upon the lambs and sloth and carp and anchovies and orangutans and breakfast cereals and fruit bats.
And good morning. Welcome to an unbalanced breakfast with Matt and Catherine. We are back for a second week. We made it all the way to week two.
Yep.
Congratulations and happy National Nutrition Month, by the way.
Yes. It's a very exciting holiday month. I'm sure everyone is aware of it and celebrating healthfully.
Mm-hmm. That's key. And if you didn't know, March 9th is Registered Dietitian Nutritionist Day. And if you're wondering what that is, you can read all about it in the Friedman Sprout, which we'll get to in 1 second. Mm-hmm. Before we do, so again, for you, if you're tuning in for the first time, this is an hour of a nutrition, fitness, and food talk. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number here is 617-627-3800. We're also on Twitter at Boxman37 and NutritionWonk if you want to let us know anything. Mm-hmm. And today's very exciting because we'll have our first guest on the show. Provided there's no equipment failures. So this is very exciting. We have Hassan Dashti joining us, who graduated from Friedman last year with his PhD and is currently a dietetic intern. So he should be joining us halfway through the show around 8:30. So definitely stay tuned for that. We'll be talking about some of the research he's done on sleep and diet and weight. And
weight gain, yeah, mm-hmm. Which has been making the news a lot recently. So that'll be exciting to learn more about.
Definitely. So looking forward to that. I think that's all we have to get out of the way and to start.
Yeah.
I mentioned the Friedman Sprout that has been published this past week.
Yep, March 1st it was up.
Mm-hmm. Always on the 1st. Mm-hmm. Might not always be in the morning, but it will be up.
Yeah.
So if you want to check that out, like I said, you can read about National Registered Dietitian Nutritionist Day, along with some updates if you're curious about the Friedman Student Council and some events going on with the different student groups there. Catherine, you have something about brown bag lunches at the school.
Yes. Like once a month, or actually every week, a professor, member of faculty comes into school to come eat their lunch with whatever students decide they want to show up. And I just kind of talk about how it's a really great opportunity. And I think that Friedman students, if you haven't already, definitely make sure that you take advantage of this opportunity. Or if you're looking into attending the Friedman School or going to Tufts, that would actually be a really great opportunity to take advantage of. Mm-hmm. And the schedule of upcoming brown bag lunches is up on the article. So mm-hmm. be sure to check that out.
Yeah, not every day you can just, or not everywhere you can just sit down with a dean and
right.
hang out for an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's also articles on there about a lot of bigger chain restaurants kind of get vilified for the amount of calories in their meals. But we have some reporting on what some of the more local establishments have and how they're not too different, actually. We have an update on some SNAP changes for retailers, food waste and expiration dates, which is always another hot topic. You can check that out. Hydration and exercise, which definitely I care about. So definitely check that out. It's a cool way to calculate how much fluid or how many fluids, how much you should drink before and after running. An exercise for working out your glutes. Whenever I exercise with my 5-year-old nephew, he always asks me what muscles everything is. So he always asks me what glutes are, and he always enjoys that because I get to tell him it's your butt. And then last but not least, a review of the Tasting Counter, another restaurant review this month. So yeah, definitely log on to freemansprout.com and check out all the news that has come out.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I just wanted to follow up on two things real quick from last week. One was brought up the coffee study about coffee saving your liver from cirrhosis,
right.
Allegedly.
Mm-hmm.
And you had asked me some details, which I was not prepared to answer at the time. So just wanted to circle back on that real quick. So the whole alcohol thing. So there was no direct relation between coffee and alcohol. It is just the general in their systematic review that they found that people who drink, or they found that you can, by drinking an average of 2 additional cups a day, you can help decrease your risk of cirrhosis. One question I had is, does that mean if you're drinking like 6 cups now, you should be having 8 cups of coffee? Because that seems a little bit extreme. That was not really specified. And the studies also, there were, I believe, 4 in the U.S., and then there were 5 other countries where they looked at studies. So they have an interesting discussion about cultural differences. Also differences in preparation and caffeine content and things like that. They do a pretty good job of describing how they're probably... It probably is the coffee. It's not just the caffeine. Like caffeine has some benefits, but they kind of controlled for, or maybe didn't control for it, but kind of acknowledge the strengths and weaknesses of attributing it to caffeine. And they conclude that it's not, that there's other stuff going on in the coffee.
So you can't
compounds.
Just go get like a Monster.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Get the
and
same
that's not
going to
have the same benefit.
A Red Bull is really not going to cure your
caffeine
cirrhosis.
Pills or anything like that. And then so they say, because it was a systematic review, it wasn't like they ran their own tests. They do recommend interventions for the future. Like if you have, or if you're at risk of cirrhosis, kind of testing, giving those people coffee, seeing what it does, which they admit is going to be pretty complicated and hard to do. And it's kind of funny because the way they phrase it, they talk about how coffee is generally well tolerated and has an excellent safety profile. So it's almost like saying that they don't come out right and say it, but they kind of do just say, maybe you should just start drinking coffee. And
I can imagine that doing a trial in that type of population would be really difficult because it'd be hard to get a bunch of people who have alcohol, like induced cirrhosis, and then
tell them.
Doesn't
have to be alcohol, though, either.
Oh, it doesn't have to
be
alcohol.
It can be a Hep B or C.
Oh, okay. Because I was like, well, you couldn't really enroll them in a study and then not try and help them with alcohol issues. So, but that makes sense that if they have Hep B or C, that maybe you could do that.
Yeah. But, coffee's not really a medication, so you don't. It's not too hard to test to give people coffee.
Right, that's true. It's hard to keep people from drinking coffee.
Exactly, yeah. All right, and the other thing to loop back on, so GMO labeling, and again, we're not going to get into a debate pro and con about GMOs themselves and the science behind all that.
But if you want to call in and argue with
Matt. A lot of people get pretty fired up about it. So again, yeah, number here, 617-673-8000, we'll brace for it.
Call and yell at us, yes.
Okay, so to follow up, first of all, that Senate bill wound up passing. I was kind of surprised because it was not pulled from the committee, but they held off the vote 2 weeks ago and voted on it on Wednesday or Thursday.
And this is the bill that makes
the Senate bill that would preempt state labeling and say states can't make their own GMO labeling requirements. They can't pass their own laws saying you have to label GMOs.
Okay.
And it had passed in the House previously, so this is the companion bill in the Senate, which... Really quick primer on policy, you have to have a bill that passes in the House and the Senate before it can go to the president to be signed off on.
Yes. For more background, you can check out Amira's Schoolhouse Rock.
Yeah, there you go. And before it gets to the full floor, it has to go through the specific committee first. So it had to get through the Ag Committee. Now it can go to the full Senate, and they're going to argue about it and amend it and change it and fight about it. And it's actually... this may sound nerdy, but this is getting pretty exciting just because they want it, because there's a deadline attached to it. Like we mentioned last week, the Vermont labeling bill goes into effect on July 1st.
Oh.
So they need to haul ass if they want to prevent anything from happening. So it did pass. 3 Democrats voted for it. So one of the main ones, Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota. So one of the interesting things about the story is that it's not necessarily a partisan vote. And you'll find out why in a second. So it passed 14-6. So that 14 was 11 Republicans, 3 Democrats to 6 Democrats. So Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota, which is also the home base of Cargill, General Mills, and Land O'Lakes. Surprise, surprise.
Mm-hmm.
They are big fans of this bill. She helped pass it, and there's some odd quotes that come out. So she says that she's fine passing it now, but she doesn't think it will pass the Senate without amendments, but she wants to get the process started, which I don't know what type of amendments you're going to get attached to this and approved by everyone. There was an attempt already by Joe Donnelly. He was another one who voted for it in committee. He's from Indiana, and he added an amendment that would, it's kind of interesting. It would like, it would make it voluntary, but if I think it's if 85% of companies weren't listing GMO ingredients in 3 years, then it would trigger and become mandatory. So I guess that's one potential amendment that you could. So it's funny because they would like pass the voluntary standards now, but if not enough people are cooperating with a voluntary measure, then it'll become mandatory. Right. So I don't know, maybe it'll work, but good luck with that. And so yeah, there's that. And then I, one of the big things too is that, actually I'll get to that in a second.
So I have a question about the voluntary labeling.
Yep.
And I thought voluntary labeling was something where, yeah, companies, they could volunteer to say that their food contains GMOs, but more likely than not, what it's going to be is foods that don't contain GMOs labeling themselves. So when he says if 85% aren't labeling, he means foods that are that do contain GMOs aren't labeling to say that they do.
Because you can, like, they have a non-GMO certified label you can stick on there.
Right, yeah.
But this is the opposite.
Okay.
And one of the main arguments is they don't want a, quote, patchwork of state laws.
Right.
But yeah, so the logic there is saying that if, you know, if 50 states have their own individual GMO labeling laws, then how can you expect these poor companies to keep up all the standards and have it's one of those kind of weak excuses. It's like they just say that you have to label GMOs. You can figure out a national label. So the idea of this national law is to have one uniform standard that everyone can adhere to and understand.
Right.
But by making it voluntary means nobody's going to do it. And so Debbie Stabenow, who had been chair of the Senate Ag Committee, is now the ranking member. She's Democrat from Michigan. She voted against it and wants a more concrete path towards mandatory labeling. She does not have faith that anything that comes from this bill and the House bill will actually lead to mandatory labeling. The third Democrat who voted for it, Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota, this is where I really lost what was going on, the logic behind this. She voted to pass it, but then told reporters that she doubted it would pass or doubted it would address the concerns of voters who have been following this issue. Okay, so why did you vote for it? And then there were some quotes later on where she's like she's anti the bill, but she voted for it. So can't really figure that one out. One other thing that this, and then Pat Leahy, who's from Vermont, also he voted with Stabenow against it and claims that it will trample states' rights. Which is interesting if you follow the partisan arguments about state versus federal rights, whereas typically the party that is pro-states' rights is Republicans,
right.
And they're the ones sponsoring this bill to prevent states from doing their own thing and having federal intervention.
Yeah.
Which is ironic. One other thing the bill would do is turn the power over from the FDA, which is in charge of GMOs and testing and all that, and give it to the USDA solely, which is already controversial because people always point to the Farm Bill, or not the Farm Bill, the dietary guidelines, and you're saying USDA is in charge of the guidelines for making Americans healthy, but they're also in charge of promoting American agriculture. So right. How do those two things reconcile it with each other? So that's another thing that people want to avoid. And so a couple other things going on in the Senate. First is Jeff Merkley has introduced kind of opposing legislation. And this would be this is his own bill. That would require labeling, but it would allow companies to choose how they do it. And it would be pretty subtle. So there's four options. Manufacturers would be given a choice of four ways to display the fact. A parenthesis to indicate the food is genetically modified, an asterisk with an explanation at the bottom of the ingredients list, the catch-all phrase produced with genetic engineering, or the FDA could develop a symbol to disclose the presence of GM ingredients.
It should be like a little syringe going into a tomato. No, I'm just kidding. It shouldn't be that. That would be so funny.
Yeah, get really scared. and then he, in a press release, he said none of these options would require front panel disclosures or warning statements intending to disparage GM ingredients.
I feel obligated to say that you can't make a GMO by putting a syringe into a
you could try, though.
You could try.
They tried to make a GM tomato and nobody.
Well, but they didn't use just like your average hospital syringe and an existing tomato.
That is
tomato.
True. That wasn't exactly the method they went about. Yeah, like a little flavor saver tomato. It failed.
Ugh.
And so Now there's, so those are the two main bills going on. No word when the Senate bill will go to the full floor to be voted on, but it's going to have to happen within the next 3 months to be able to stop Vermont. And then it's also interesting because in the Senate, there's also now an effort, again, this is not necessarily going by partisan lines, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, which is a big hint as to why she would do this. She's been very opposed to GE salmon, which if you were not aware was approved by the FDA for sale last year. And currently, it's not available yet. They're still working on the plan. Basically, they are going to breed the eggs in, or that doesn't make sense, but they're going to produce eggs in on Prince Edward Island in Canada and then grow them in a facility of Panama. So this wouldn't actually be taking place in the U.S. So to take advantage of that, the FDA has actually listened to a lot of, there was no labeling requirement when they approved the salmon. So now the FDA has decided to block any import of the salmon, since it's not going to be in the United States to start, until they figure out a labeling policy.
Okay.
And Senator Murkowski, who's a Republican again from Alaska, salmon is pretty important to Alaska,
right,
has introduced new legislation to require GMO labeling on salmon. So again, I believe that would be a federal requirement, so they'll have to...
So they it doesn't conflict with the other...
It doesn't conflict, no, because it wouldn't be Alaska requiring this. It would be federal, okay. But it's also interesting to note that she is Republican, so is Pat Roberts, who chaired the Senate Ag Committee. So you have Democrats from Minnesota looking out for their state with the general law, and then you have a Republican in Alaska watching out for her state in the salmon. So this is all pretty exciting for any policy people out there. And then real quick, too, because I know that you kind of commented on, do people actually know what GMOs are last week? So one argument I also saw against GM labeling isn't necessarily, well, you have the whole right to know thing. They're like, it's not about GMOs are bad. It's just that people want to know. They want to know what they're eating. So why don't you just label it? And the other argument is that there's a connection between glyphosate, which is now going to be tested for by the FDA. So glyphosate is better known as Roundup. The big Monsanto herbicide, and this goes back to the whole core of GMOs, where GMOs were developed to resist glyphosate, so that they could still grow. You could douse them in these pesticides, and they could still grow.
Right.
And now the World Health Organization has labeled glyphosate as being probable human carcinogen. You have a whole huge thing in Europe right now because it has to be re-licensed for use in the European Union, and that license is going to be running out this summer. And people want to vote to relicense it, but a lot of countries are going to rebel against that and do not want to allow it. And then because of the FDA now testing, that's another reason people argue for labeling. It'd be kind of like, I don't know, it's almost like a made in USA thing. Like if you want to, you know, if you want to show that you're anti-glyphosate, you wouldn't buy a GMO product. Like,
but
same thing.
I'm confused. Do you know anything about, like, so it's not as if crops that aren't Roundup ready or don't use glyphosate, it's not as if they don't have pesticides, right? So is there any like kind of comparative toxicology type, you know, data available that people can go and look up and see? Okay, because I wonder if it's a probable human carcinogen. That's concerning. Lots of things are probable human carcinogens, including red meat. So, and people aren't about to be like, well, I'm not going to eat steak anymore. They're like, okay, it's good that I have this information and now I can make, measured decisions. I wonder if there's any type of information or organization that kind of does labeling like that. Do you have any idea?
I don't know off the top of my head, but you can check out.
We will look into
the,
that.
If you Google the World Health Organization, they have a link to the organization that studied that, and then they also have a link to an study that opposes that, saying it's not that the data is flawed and that it's not a human carcinogen. And then there's a bunch of argument back and forth.
So it really seems like a lot of the representatives in the Senate and in the House, when they're blocking, when they want there to be GMO labeling, it's not so much that they have ethical concerns about GMOs so much as that they're representing their constituencies. So if they want it to be labeled, they have some reason. For instance, Alaska has a salmon industry and they would prefer that people kind of be worried about other salmon sources. And then, when you represent Cargill and all these other sort of corn, soy growers, they don't want there to be GMO labeling, not because they're worried about GMOs necessarily, but because they want to be representing their state. So it's maybe not so much of like an ethical issue for these folks. But I think though the wider idea, right, is that people are worried about GMOs as something that's dangerous. And I think that there's limited evidence that a GMO itself is dangerous.
That is true. And then it also brings up the question, what is your constituent? Is it Cargill, or is it the 90% of Americans who want a GMO label, regardless of what the reasoning
might
be?
So, right.
Yeah, that's just something to ponder there. I like how, so Tim Ryan is a Democrat from Ohio. He said he's sensitive to the argument of a patchwork preventing that, like all the states having their different laws. But he says it's a BS excuse to subvert the idea of transparency. And then one other thing to note is that Campbell's Soup has come out in defense of GMO labeling. They're pro-GMO labeling. They've broken from the industry. They say that, I mean, basically they're saying that the people want it. And so we might, they almost have like a sound of inevitability. Like, this is going to happen.
Right.
Why don't we just label it now? And who
they're
really cares? Because all we do is like, we print a whole text on our label. Done.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Is it really that hard?
And I think if people really want there to be labeling, then hopefully if and when there is labeling, there'll be much better resources for understanding what GMOs are. Because I think right now, a lot of the issue around it is that companies are worried that people don't understand what a genetically modified organism is. And there's kind of this like eerie cloud of worry that people have.
Yeah, it's all... it's all crazy. A whole ton of stuff you can sink your teeth into.
Yeah. But instead, we should probably eat bugs.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us why?
Yeah. So a recent study that actually was published in 2016, but it was online and back in September, where a group of scientists, Charlotte Payne, Dr. Charlotte Payne et al., published in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition about comparing the like macronutrient content and health content of bugs as food sources, as insects for food sources. So there's been a lot of talk about how potentially having people switch from cattle, from pigs, over to eating insects for protein and for nutrients, because they lower greenhouse gases, they're more sustainable, and a lot of people argue that they're probably healthier. Well, this paper says actually there hasn't been a lot of research into whether or not these are healthier sources of protein and nutrients. And so what they did was they took some popular insects for eating that are farmed, that are actually already farmed so that you can, for food purposes, and they did a nutrient comparison between those insects and then between popular meats. So they did beef, pork, and then they did offal, beef offal, and they did an overall comparison. And what's really interesting is that they did a comparison using two different types of scoring methods. So each food was given a score based on its nutrient content, but they used two different scoring methods. One was the Ofcom model, which is what is used in the UK for scoring foods and then being able to kind of put limits on them and limit food advertising for children. So that's sort of the developed country model of, we don't want more people to develop obesity and diabetes. We're going to be looking at these foods in terms of whether they're weight gain promoting or, you know, chronic disease promoting, and labeling them that way. And then they also use the nutrient value score, which is generally used when you're working with developing nations and there's a big risk for undernutrition. So people who aren't going to get enough to eat. And so it was really interesting that they labeled them from both perspectives. So you could see, well, how good of a food source is this? And in the, you know, scenario where there isn't any food, and how good of a food source is this in a scenario where there's too much food? And so they wound up kind of finding some really interesting things. One of their major conclusions is that we shouldn't lump all insects together as like a food group. So it shouldn't be like beef, pork, insects. Different insects have really different nutrient values. In particular, 100 grams of palm weevil larvae, which sounds delicious, but is farmed for consumption. 100 grams has about 479 calories in it. And for comparison, 100 grams of beef is 169. So if you're looking in terms of energy, you know, in total energy, it's either the best source or the worst source.
Wait, why is that? Is it because it just density, or is it, does it have...
It would be energy density. So what they actually look at is protein, fat, and saturated fat. So usually any animal or living non-plant source of energy is going to be very low in carbohydrate. Mm-hmm. Meat is low in carbohydrate.
Yep.
Insects are similarly low in carbohydrate. So they actually look at protein content, fat, and then they look at saturated fat, and they look at sodium. And so insects generally tend to have, they'll have higher sodium. And palm weevils have 9.84 grams of saturated fat per 100 grams,
okay.
which is, you know, three times, well, maybe twice what beef has per 100 grams. And so they're kind of saying, well, for chronic disease risk, you're probably better off having a little bit of beef. But if you want bang for your buck in terms of energy density, you definitely want to go with palm weevil. Which it's probably not available at your grocery store at the moment, but it's probably on the horizon. And so they kind of took a look at that, and their final conclusions were really interesting. They basically sort of, so they say that insects, quote unquote insects, is not a useful food category in terms of discussing health and nutrition because they are very different. And then they also say, and I quote, "Overall, the data presented here shows no evidence that any commercially available insect evaluated in the current study is significantly preferable to meat for the purpose of combating diet-related disease caused by overnutrition." And so while environmentally it makes a lot of sense, and in developing nations where you need easy, available, and low-resource sort of farming methods, it might be a really great idea. The sustainability argument is better right now than the health argument. So I thought that was a really interesting study. I guess I had always assumed, for some reason I grew up thinking like crickets have a lot of protein. I've never eaten a cricket. Yeah,
crickets are always like the go-to.
Yeah, the people say stuff about crickets. I mean, I don't know why they have such a health halo around them. I've never eaten a cricket. But at the moment, crickets do not seem to be
So is this the testing that they did? Is this like as if you were to pick up a... just scoop up a handful of larvae and throw them down? It doesn't take into account, because you can buy flour and chips and things like that.
Oh, yeah. I think they're looking at the whole bug. Okay. Yeah. So I don't know what happens when you make cricket into cricket flour, if it's like the entire cricket that's dehydrated and crushed, which would probably be just a much more energy dense version of regular cricket, mm-hmm. or if they're taking out all of the fat and it's like cricket protein powder. So like a whey powder. Mm-hmm. I don't know the differences in that, but I imagine it's 100 grams of just straight crickets or 100 grams of, you know, a piece of beef.
Nice. That's crazy. I'm looking forward to like the big, you know, whatever group does it online where they have the big nutrient database of all, like you can type in spiders and crickets, and
yeah,
it's going to give you all your
you eat eight spiders in your sleep. I don't know if that's true, but
the vitamins you got and the sodium.
They're probably
you're now at risk of hypertension because you're eating too many bugs. All right. And then, so real quick, do you want to touch on juicing?
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the Boston juice situation, which you probably weren't aware of as a situation. But I recently had a bit of a dental mishap where I bumped my tooth. And for a few days, I was like subsisting on smoothies. And of course, rather than be like, I will now cleanse, I thought, how can I drink as much versions of peanut butter as I possibly can? And I wound up visiting a number of wonderful Boston juicing and smoothie stores. And what I realized was that even though a lot of these stores, that you walk in, they smell like produce, they have fresh produce everywhere, the idea is it's super healthy. There's a place called like Liquiteria in Harvard Square that has some type of cleanse you can buy, like where you eat, I don't know, you're eating nothing but juice. There are a lot of reasons why a juice cleanse isn't a great idea, and I won't delve into that now, but just FYI, it's not a great idea, and it's probably not that enjoyable. But weirdly, none of these places had visible nutrition facts. So if I walk into a Panera Bread or, you know, even a McDonald's, I'm going to be able to see how many calories are in this, how much sugar is in it, how much fat, etc. But none of these places voluntarily showed their nutrition facts. And so I had to ask them, and they would pull it out of a binder in the counter. They would pull it out of this binder and I would look at it. And half the time, the nutrition facts wouldn't add up. So this is just a call to Boston juice providers. Please, please show us your calories.
That's, yeah, you should just go around and police all that and see who's not adhering.
Right.
All right. So we're going to take a song break real quick.
We'll I got talk to about pick these, this one.
Yeah, you got to pick. So we're going to do first one from Lake Street Dive called You Go Down Smooth. And then a new one from the band, Say Anything. So enjoy. Mm-hmm.
Sophie.
All right, welcome back to An Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO 91.5 FM in Medford, streaming live on WMFO.org. You just heard the song Give a Damn by the band Say Anything, who kind of dropped an album without any fanfare or previous knowledge last month. Before that, we had Lake Street Dive, which is Catherine's choice.
Yep.
Yeah, you get to do some input here for music.
I finally got to choose. I initially had the Beach Boys song called Vegetables, and Matt was like, why?
Yeah,
I thought it had to be food related.
Yeah, we kind of nixed that because there's not a ton of great food songs out there. But maybe
you only
maybe
nixed it when I wanted to play the Beach Boys song called Vegetables, which does exist, and you should for sure play it. You should.
We'll see. We'll get to it
in your house.
Oh, I tried listening to it. I also wanted to, we also played a song last week from the band Psycho Stick, which I forgot to announce. Supposed to announce all the songs. But that was This Is Not a Song. It's a Sandwich off their album Sandwich. That band is known for their Ode to Beer from a few weeks ago, or a few years ago. All right, now hopefully this works. I'm going to throw it over to Catherine, who's going to introduce our guest that we now have on the line.
Great. Hi, Hassan. Can you hear us?
Yes, I could.
Okay.
Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Great. So, okay, so I'll take a second and introduce you, and then I'll let you introduce yourself. But so Hassan is a student, was a student at the Friedman School of Nutrition doing a PhD, and has kind of collaborated on a number of papers. And so I decided to pick two of his more recent publications and chat about them with him a little bit. And they deal with sleep and obesity, which has been coming up in the news a lot. One of the more headline-making studies has been that, like, you know, not sleeping can give you the munchies, like as if you've been using marijuana and you're hungry. And so I was like, well, this is an interesting idea. And so I actually looked and found that Hassan has done a number of papers on this very subject. So Hassan, would you like to maybe tell us a little bit about your background?
Yes, of course. So to start off, like many Friedman students, my undergraduate training was not actually nutrition, it was in genetics. So I had completed my undergrad at the University of Pennsylvania in genetics. But at that point, I had an interest in nutrition, again, like many Friedman students. Because of my training in genetics, I wanted to do something that was related to genetics and nutrition, and I found the Human Nutrition Research Center does have a lab that focuses on nutrition and genomics, which is how I ended up at Tufts. While at Tufts, I worked with Dr. Jose Ordovas, who is a geneticist. And I'll talk more about the kind of work that we do there later on. But I was essentially working on personalizing nutrition or nutrigenomics, again, something that I'll elaborate on in a bit. So I was there for 5 years, and I graduated in spring of 2015. And I've made my way to the Brigham and Women, where I'm currently a dietetic intern, completing my training in clinical nutrition.
Oh, wow. Well, congratulations on finishing. That must have been very exciting.
Thank you. Yes, it was, definitely.
So I was going to chat with you about a couple of your papers. One was Habitual, and I'll read the names just so you can get an idea of how technical these papers are. Habitual sleep duration associated with BMI and macronutrient intake may be modified by clock genetic variance. And actigraphic sleep fragmentation efficiency and duration associated with dietary intake in the Rotterdam study. So
this is why you're leading this interview. This is not my forte.
I did that to be obnoxious, I guess. So next time I'll break it down a little bit more. But can you talk a little bit? So for the first study, is habitual sleep duration associated with is modified by clock genetic variance? What is clock? What were you looking at in this study?
Okay, so I think a good place to start is to talk about nutrigenomics and what the lab actually does.
Great.
So it's a new field of nutrition. It's been around for a few years, and you're going to hear more about it in the near future. But it's basically understanding how nutrients and genetics or genomics interact with one another. So we understand and we recognize that people respond to food differently, and that is one of the reasons because of our genetics. Mm-hmm. So a very basic example, which many people can relate to, is lactose intolerance. Mm-hmm. So some people have the genetic variant of the lactase enzyme, which is the enzyme that breaks down lactose, the sugar found in dairy and milk. So they're able to consume dairy into their adulthood, whereas some people cannot because they are lacking, or they have that variant of the gene that does not allow them to break down the sugar. So the dietary recommendation for these individuals would be to avoid lactose or to avoid dairy, mm-hmm. just for them not to experience this abdominal pain, the bloating. So that is just an example of how we could use genetics to personalize our dietary recommendations. Mm-hmm. And the end point is personalizing nutrition, tailoring our dietary recommendations, rather than making these general recommendations like the dietary guidelines that might not be appropriate for everyone.
Right.
So the group of genes that I was looking at are called the clock genes. Mm-hmm. And they're involved in this, in our, the biological clock or the human internal clock. The main function of the clock, I mean, it does many, many things, but the main function is to make sure that not all biologic processes in the human body occur at the same time. Mm-hmm. So just to space things out throughout the day. And the most relatable example, again, is the sleep-wake cycle. So we're not asleep and awake at the same time. They are separated by time. We're awake during the day and asleep at night, and that is regulated by this clock. So that got me thinking and interested in sleep. And at the Friedman School, we look at how to improve people's nutrition and health. We primarily focus on diet and physical activity. And it's surprising that not many people consider sleep just because of their interests. And we do spend a third of our lifetime sleeping. Mm-hmm. So many neuroscientists have investigated sleep and why people sleep, and they know that it's important for mood, for memory, for well-being, many reasons. Mm-hmm. And more recently, we were starting to understand that sleep is also important for cardiometabolic health. So it's important for to keep our weight stable, to prevent diabetes, cardiovascular disease, which are all related, again, to nutrition. Mm-hmm. So one part of this project is to investigate how does our sleep influences what we eat. Mm-hmm. That part does not have a genetic component. But then for the second part, it's to understand how do people with different genetic variants or different variants of a gene, the clock gene,
right,
which regulates sleep and the circadian clock, mm-hmm. The people with different versions of that gene may need tailored dietary may need tailored lifestyle recommendations. Mm-hmm. And again, the lifestyle recommendation would be related to how long they sleep.
So essentially what you're saying is that you're seeing different eating patterns in people based on how long they're sleeping habitually. So how long they tend to get sleep per night. But then you're also seeing additional variations based on how their sleep time interacts with clock genes, which then interact with their intake?
Exactly. Okay. So, there are two parts, and this was the two aims of the study.
Mm-hmm. And so when you found those differences between people who had different sort of different alleles or different ways of expressing clock genes, what were their recommendations that you, at the end, you were like, oh, well, this will be interesting. Maybe certain people should make different dietary changes?
Okay, so I'll describe the results. I think the main results that we found was actually the non-genetic results was that people who do sleep shorter, so the shorter sleepers tend to have higher BMI, so they tend to be heavier, which is consistent with many previous studies that mm-hmm. have been done, including a study that was done by the dean of the Friedman School.
Mm-hmm.
But this was the largest study to look at the relationship between sleep and dietary intake. So we were looking at a total of over 15,000 individuals and how different sleep timings or different hours of sleep might influence their intake. And what we found was that those who sleep shorter tend to have unhealthier diets.
Okay.
So specifically shorter sleep duration. Young adults tend to eat more saturated fats, so the unhealthier fats, whereas older women who tend to sleep shorter have higher carbs in their intake and lower intakes of the healthier fats, which is the PUFA.
Okay.
So consistent with previous findings, smaller findings, was our observation that those who are achieving the recommended hours of sleep, which is generally 7 to 9 hours of sleep, have a healthier dietary profile. And then considering the genetic part, again, as you've mentioned, we wanted to see whether some people might not need that many hours of sleep. So we were looking at genetic variants in this clock gene, and what we identified was also data that suggests that even those who have specific variants of the clock gene that might predispose them to obesity, they still need more sleep. So all in all, to make things simple and short, 7 to 9 hours of sleep, regardless of your DNA, tend to be the optimal sleep duration for adults.
Oh, okay, great. And so maybe if you had some genes that predispose you to obesity, getting enough sleep could help maybe ameliorate some of that effect?
Exactly.
Okay. Wow, that's great. Yeah, so get good sleep, everyone. And I think your other paper kind of touches on something similar, which is where you had the people who partook in the study, they were actually wearing something that measured their sleep?
Yes.
In the sleep fragmentation. So can you talk a little bit about how that study works? So this is sleep fragmentation and then how that associates with dietary intake.
So the previous study that I mentioned, the earlier one, we looked at sleep duration. What I did not mention is that it was self-reported sleep. So people told us how long they were able to sleep. And that's just an easy way to get more people involved in your study. We were able to get this from over 15,000 individuals. But we know that people don't always know how long they sleep. You might think you know how much you sleep, but it might not actually be true. And the same applies to dietary intake. People might think what they ate, but they don't really know. So in order to avoid that error in reporting, for this study, what they did, or what we did, was measure sleep through the use of a device called an actigraph, which is similar to a Fitbit. It is an accelerometer that measures hand movement, and that allows us to objectively measure sleep duration. But you also need to know that sleep duration is only one parameter of sleep. So sleep has also other dimensions, such as fragmentation, so how disrupted your sleep is, and efficiency, so how well you sleep. So you might be sleeping 7 to 9 hours, but if your sleep is not restful, that is not as good as having 7 to 9 hours of restful sleep. So with the advent of new technology like the Fitbit or the actigraph, we're now able to objectively measure sleep, and not only duration, but also efficiency and fragmentation. And what we found here, we confirmed our previous results, was that short sleepers, so individuals who were sleeping shorter, they were consuming up to 210 extra calories per night. So they were eating more than people who were obtaining longer sleep durations. And then we were able to look at fragmentation and efficiency. What we found was that those with more fragmented sleep tend to consume higher carbohydrate diets, or they're associated with a diet that's higher in carbohydrate intake.
Right. That's really interesting. And so what you're basically saying is that the fragment, how many times you have to get up during the night, or how many times even you're just moving or not having restful sleep, is going to have an effect, not just how long you're sleeping. So could someone maybe do, like, if you had a Fitbit, could they do this experiment on themselves even? I don't recommend experimenting on yourself, but in theory, could somebody do an experiment on themselves and see how much am I eating when I don't get enough sleep and how much am I eating when I am getting enough sleep?
You could definitely do that. Actually, the very first study to look at the relationship between sleep duration and intake was done in college students. So the college students were asked to sleep at specific hours and record their diet. And they were asked to change their sleep duration and record their new diet. And they compared how differences in sleep duration influenced their dietary intake. So you could definitely do that through the use of Fitbit, or even just by simply writing down when you went to sleep and when you woke up, and seeing how that might be influencing your dietary choices, your weight, your mood as well.
Oh, that's really interesting. So you're not, so you kind of touched on this at the beginning, but you didn't just finish your PhD, you're now doing your dietetic internship. So in addition to being, you know, a scientist, you're also going to be a dietitian. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what was your inspiration to go into dietetics, and do you see there being a specific role for people who have that dietetics background in nutrition science, and what's your view on that?
So there isn't one reason why I decided to do this, mm-hmm. But the two main reasons, the first one being that I wanted to get that clinical dietetics training. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be exposed to this specialized population that are critically malnourished. Since my PhD did not focus on that, I wasn't able to learn a lot about it. And it was just a fast way to get trained in a hospital and seeing how people with different diseases are being managed nutritionally. The second reason is there's a great article in the Friedman Sprout on the role of a dietitian, mm-hmm. and they highlight how dietitians have a major role in communicating research, communicating nutrition in general, and nutrition-related research. And I just wanted to get that training in being able to transfer information from the literature or from original publications to the community, and making sure that the message is coming across effectively. And this is really important for our field of nutrigenomics, which is a new field.
Right.
And it does involve genetics, and it's a very tricky field. So making sure that people do not misinterpret those results because of the layer of genetics that's involved.
Right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This is all really interesting. Definitely check out the article on the Friedman Sprout about dietitians. National Dietitian Day is coming up. Thank you so much, Hassan, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for getting up so
Matt
early.
Matt has a final question.
I wanted to mention, too, you can read more about Hassan's work in the winter edition of the Tufts Nutrition Magazine. Some good quotes and explanations of the studies going on there. And one other thing, Hassan, you ran the Boston Marathon last year?
I did in 2015, yes.
Excellent. Congratulations. And how'd that go?
Thank you. It went well, surprisingly. It was 10 days before my thesis defense.
Oh my gosh.
It was a very stressful month for me. But I'm not sure which one was more stressful, but the marathon was definitely a challenge.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, cool. Very cool. Thank you again for joining us. And like I said, you can check out Hassan's work online. And yeah, thanks. Thank you very much.
Yeah, enjoy
Thank
the rest
you,
of your internship. Yeah. Thanks. Have a good morning. Have a good weekend.
All right. Well, very cool. So that's our first guest, Hassan Dashti.
Yes. Thank you so much. We haven't had a guest yet. So thank you, Hassan, for doing that.
Went well. Yeah. Do you want to talk? So we should have another guest next week, right? Do you want to talk?
Yeah, so next week we are having Chrissy Connell. She is a blogger and she has her own nutrition consulting business. So she does nutrition and fitness with different companies. And then she also has her blog, Snacking in Sneakers, and she is a triathlete. So it'll be really interesting to kind of see, and she's also a registered dietitian. So she's going to be in the dietetics world kind of coming from the opposite side. So she's working all in communications, all in behavior change with different groups of people. So definitely you're going to want to tune in and hear her kind of talk about her journey.
Awesome. So very, very big things happening. It's only week two and we have a whole slate of guests that we have lined up for the next few months.
Mm-hmm.
A couple quick things before we get out of here I wanted to mention. Going back to coffee real quick, I don't know if you saw the story, but do you know Jaromir Jagr, the hockey player? He's been around since 1990. So he's 44 years old and is leading the Florida Panthers right now in points. And they're playoff bound. He's had a career renaissance. And one of the things that he's credited recently is he gives up something for Lent every year. And for Lent, he gave up coffee this year. He started drinking coffee last year after he gave up Diet Coke. So he used to drink five Diet Cokes a day. gave that up for Lent, and then could no longer drink soda when he tried to go back.
Really?
So then he was up to, he claims he was drinking 10 cups of coffee a day.
Oh my gosh.
Playing this season, which was apparently working for him. But then he decided to give that up for Lent, cold turkey. So if you want to see, I don't really know what it says. It was a sample size of one of the effects of Diet Coke and coffee on
is
your athletic
Lent
performance.
Is Lent during the hockey season at all?
Oh yeah.
You would think it would be like in his contract, like, please don't make any major habit changes.
Yeah. But yeah, so stay. And then one other athletic related thing is Conor McGregor fights tomorrow night, tonight, UFC 168. And the only thing, reason I bring that up is he was fighting at featherweight, which has a 145-pound weight limit. And now for this fight, he's fighting Nate Diaz at 165 pounds. You can see the difference in his body type, which is crazy. And it would just be interesting tonight to see how that affects him. I mean, he's one of the best fighters in the world right now. And is he going to like come out still being Conor McGregor, or is he going to get totally gassed and crazy because he's gained 20 pounds in a few months for this fight? So a couple of interesting sports related things for you.
All right.
So just about done here. Also, Whole Foods has pulled their pre-peeled oranges.
Oh, yes. This was a huge scandal. Somebody took a photo. I think it posted on Twitter or Instagram. Whole Foods was selling pre-peeled oranges in plastic containers, so like in little Tupperwares. And I think somebody tweeted, if only oranges had a natural covering.
Right. Although there was a backlash because people were pointing out that people with disabilities, physical or otherwise, may not be able to peel an orange. So that was an interesting little tidbit that happened. But they were pulled. All right, so that does it for us. Stay tuned for Mike on the Mic coming up next, and we will see you next week, same place, same time. You can check us out online in the meantime at unbalancedbreakfast.wordpress.com, also at Unbalanced Breakfast Radio on Facebook, and our SoundCloud account where you can download episodes of the show. We will see you next weekend.
Yeah, have a great weekend.